dormant and harmless to themselves, in their lungs, of all places. One cough, it is said, could kill millions in the outer world, and so the outer world has made a jail of the continent. Urathi princes never meet their foreign counterparts. Urathi ships are sunk on sight. But there is a softer face of quarantine. Zavacendran doctors are sprinkled across Urath, treating lesser diseases, binding wounds, drawing parasites from the blood, and above all, hunting for the secret of Urathi immunity.
"We can reason with those doctors," says Mektu. "We can explain that we don't want any part of this war."
"And then?"
"We get one of them to say that we're ill, that we need to be taken to one of their special hospitals."
"You're a genius," says Khandri. "I'm sure no one's thought of that before."
"Don't be nasty. It's a decent plan. And you have the imagination of a stump."
"The doctors take an oath of non-interference," said Khandri. "And they travel with army escorts. Also, they're not here."
"Not here?"
"The captain told us last week. Not one Zavacendran left in the camp, and none expected before midsummer. Otherwise, it's an excellent plan."
Mektu, silenced, walks stiffly at his side. Khandri considers whether or not he has been cruel. One hides certain crushing truths from children. Why not from soldiers? Are they any more likely to know what to do with them? Are they any stronger in the end?
"Forget the Zavacendrans," says his brother at last. "They're not what I came to tell you about. Listen, I have something for you."
"No, thanks."
"And one for me, of course. We'll need them. It was worth the risk."
"What risk, Mech? What the hell are you talking about?"
"I took 2 bush kits," says Mektu.
"You what?"
"Devil's rectum!"
Khandri's cry turns heads. The brothers march, frightened as 2 beaten dogs. But no one approaches, and after a few paces, Mektu is buoyant again, prancing, smirking.
"I will never be rid of you," Khandri thinks.
Bush kits are survival packages, kept ready for couriers or commandos, anyone the army might dispatch in haste on some urgent errand. Khandri has never touched one. They are more an idea than a physical presence in the camp.
"No one knows, no one knows," hisses Mektu. "We were unloading 50 wagons from the north. The kits were at the bottom of a mountain of loot from the siege of Misafa Palace. Rugs, silks, leopard skins, ladies' slippers. But when we cut off the tarp, we found it was infested with blackworms. They told me to burn it all."
"Stay away from me," says Khandri, "until you wise up.
I'm sorry, I just can't." "The worms never reached the bush kits, Khandri. They're sealed. They're absolutely fine. I burned the rest, but I put the kits in a sack under my bed."
Under his bed. Khandri twists on his heel, drags his brother into an alley between 2 tents. When he is sure no one can see them, he grabs Mektu's uniform just below the throat.
"You shit. Listen close. If you can't stop this nonsense, I'm going to report you myself. Do you hear me? I'll tell them you're a nutcase. What else can I do? Maybe they'll just lock you up instead of feeding you to the fucking dogs."
His brother's hands are in fists.
"A nutcase," he says. "I want to get out of here. You want to stay and serve her radiance until she sends us off to the Galsine slaughterhouse. But I'm the nutcase, am I?
I don't know what the hell you are. But I swear on our mother, my mother. Yours died in a barn."
Khandri is speechless. Once again, that blow to the stomach, that pitiless assault. He looks his brother coldly in the eye.
"I swear on our mother," he repeats, "that if you run for the valley, I'll denounce you. I'll tell them our family's not responsible, that they didn't know your plan. I'll tell them I did everything I could to make you stay."
Mektu stands frozen. Then his eyes move up and down Khandri's body. It is a look no one accustomed to violence can mistake.
"You wouldn't really do that."
"I just swore to do it, Mech." Late evening. Khandri has purchased a bottle of fine cane liquor at the cost of 6 days' pay. A moment of weakness, or inspiration, perhaps. He has tried to share it with such friends as he has in Eternity Camp, but they are suddenly busy at his approach, recalling promises to be elsewhere. Well, fuck them. He takes a long first swig. Bliss and pain commingled, sweet honey and a blow to the skull. He has become a pariah. But why, exactly? Has Mektu's chatter reached an officer? Has Skem been talking of his plans to put a knife in Condry's ribs? Whatever else is happening, the Feast of the Boar rolls on. Tonight, the pig's organs and viscera have been fried with chilies and scarlet palm oil. The smell wafts through the camp, irresistible, driving men mad. Condry, his timing lucky for once, queues for an hour and receives 3 inches of intestine and a grape-sized cut of lung. The men ahead and behind him keep their distance. Not even the server meets his eye. He wolfs the meat and chases it with liquor. A private feast, a celebration of solitude. Then he goes in search of Chindelin. In the 2 hours since his standoff with Mektu, Condry has felt a burning need to speak with the smith. Their last meeting shook Condry to the core, and somehow he knows that their next will change everything. What he does not know, however deeply he probes his own heart, is what he will say to Chindelin. "Uncle, I'm on my knees now. You have friends among the officers. Call on them." "Uncle, I am no longer joking. I will shatter his foot, leave him crippled but alive." "Uncle, I'm abandoning the fool." Chindelin is not in the weapon shop, however, nor any of his usual haunts. When Condry inquires with the men in his unit, they shrug. Only when he refuses to leave does one of them face him directly.
"The Master Smith went off to the village, hours ago."
"The village? What for?
What the fuck do you think?"
From the back of the tent, another soldier says,
"Pussy, Hingeman! Some of us like it. We're strange that way."
Condry walks. The village begins a quarter mile east of the camp, just beyond the barren security zone declared by the army. He is deeply unsettled, but not by the soldiers' derision. Something is wrong. Chindelin does not go whoring. He has occasional liaisons with a widow from Doled, a fruit vendor who supplies the officer's mess.
"She's trouble enough," is all he says if the subject arises.
Condry has never once seen him on Brothel Row. Tonight, for the first time in months, the east gate stands open. 20 sentries guard the narrow exit, glumly sober, patting down the revelers for contraband, for theft. Press-ganged Chiloto boys stagger across the drawbridge over the pit, grabbing their crotches, jingling coins. Once outside, prostitutes descend on them like crows. Condry, too, is quickly surrounded.
"Bargain, bargain,"
say the women, their labor-roughened hands traveling his skin. He keeps a grip on his coin purse, but he passes the bottle around. "Have they seen Chindelin, the blacksmith?" The women shake their heads, cooing and sighing over the liquor. When he takes the bottle back, it is 2/3 drained. No, he's not buying sex. Their smiles harden into scorn.
"Luli,"
they mumble, predictably. But a young woman in a tattered sarong puts her arms about his neck and kisses him, long and deep.
"Thanks for the drink," she says.
The village is almost lightless. Most of the huts are closed tight as drums, the dogs cringing and slinking back from the soldiers. Village dogs learn quickly. The chickens caged for the night. Chickens, daughters, sons. Because of his injury in the Galsune campaign, Condry has not seen the village on a feast night in over a year. Now it all comes back. The shattered bottles, discarded bones, the silent paths between those homes of mud and straw. The Kiprifani merchant in the village center, hawking drugs to promote virility, ward off disease. Between the huts he has a glimpse of the Badlands, stretching east to the Stolen Sea. Nothing out there beyond the first few grassy miles. Nothing but death. Brothel Row is merry, however. No bloodshed. The night is young. A fat man with a pushcart winks at him, lifting a bottle.
"One sip a night protects your privates, friend. Why gamble? You know where those girls have been.
He moves from house to house, seeking Chindelin. In the first three, no luck at all. But in the last and largest business, Auntie Boom Booms, a soldier nods. Smiling and very drunk, he points Condry down a long, narrow passage.
Last door on the right, Hingeman. Don't knock. It's another waiting room. Give us that bottle a minute.
Condry passes him the liquor, has to wrestle it back. He moves down the hallway. Painted words on the floor read, no refunds, no pain games, no boots in bed. The hallway darkens as he goes, however, and by the time he reaches its end, he is practically groping. When he opens the door, he sees Colonel Idaru, Lord O'Julon's deputy, being serviced by a slender woman kneeling on a pelt. Idaru turns him a furious scowl, and Condry, panicked, slams the door with a bang. His helpful comrade has fled. Those who remain smirk at him over their tankards.
"Hingeman," says one, "is it true that your brother once crawled into a smokehouse and tried to cure himself like a ham? Did he do that? We've got this wager, see?"
Condry's first thought is to break the man's teeth, but Idaru could emerge at any moment. Furious and ashamed, he stalks from the brothel. In the barren yard, men are splurging on plates of wheatik, hairless mice drowned in batter and fried, while a boy with a tin whistle kicks at a small chained monkey festooned with girlish bows, trying to make the creature dance. He crosses the yard, forcing himself not to run. In the alley, he quickens his pace, turns one corner and then another, losing himself. Coward. Fool. The night air cold in his chest. Retreating to a darkened doorway, he lifts the bottle to his lips.
"Uncle, can I truly maim my brother? Crush his foot with a sledgehammer, an iron cartwheel, the anvil in your shop? And would even that be enough to save him? Would they send him home, or just chain him to a workstation, to a sink?"
Footsteps, swift and heavy. Condry swallows his mouthful and takes another. The hell with everything. This night has a feeling of doom. But the feet pass him by. He lowers the bottle and sees four soldiers, almost running, locked in a whispered argument. Clearly no one's seen him. But before they vanish around the corner, one man raises his voice.
"I told you, didn't I? This is the last place he'd go."
Condry steps from his alcove, thinking, "That was strange." Huge brutes, all four of them. A Koli militia, perhaps, or even Orthodox guard. But who could they be searching for? In any event, they are gone. And all at once, Condry realizes that his fear is gone as well. It can't be him they want, for the simple reason that Idaru cannot have seen his face. The chamber was bright, but Condry himself had remained in the shadowy hall. The colonel was squinting in his direction, not scowling. And a Koli militia aren't summoned to chase down a man for opening the wrong door in a brothel. No danger, then. No one after him at all. He drinks, feet and mind wandering, thinking of the kiss of the young prostitute, thinking of Arikina Nawal. She was only 2 years his senior, but even in their teens, he rarely thought of her as a girl. She felt too much, knew too much. She had a fullness of heart that left him shocked and sorry for lesser people, grown men and women included. She wasn't normal. She was Arikina, a category of one. On their last night together, he had given her his cap, an old thing of uncombed wool, round, plain, faded from scarlet to fishgill pink. She adored it. On cold nights, she wore it beneath the hood of her shemlet, but only in the hills when the two of them walked alone. Condry had tried to make a gift of it many times. Arikina refused, and took care that no one but Condry ever saw it on her head. A woman did not wear a man's clothing unless they were lovers. It was unwritten valley law. Of course, they were lovers by then, the peasant and the genius, Condry the tree pruner and Arikina the doctor, the healer, the unstoppable force. That night she'd worn the cap only briefly, then returned it, saying she wasn't cold. Condry had crushed the hat into his pocket. but later, on an impulse, he'd slipped it into her shoulder bag, under the medical kit she was never without. It was easy. Arikina was sleeping with her head on his lap. She stole many such naps on their night walks, pulling him down with her in some distant meadow or shed or cedar grove, holding him, gone in mid-sentence, pinched out like a flame. She was so often exhausted. Sleep was a fugitive thing in the household she shared with two elder cousins, anxious to marry, an aunt who took in street dogs, an insomniac rooster forever shrieking of doomsday. And at any hour, a summons might come for Dr. Arikina, from the clinic, or from any house in any village, up or down the Satapre.
"This is where I'm safe," Ari would whisper. "Here in the darkness with you guarding my sleep."
A gust of wind blows sand along the alley. He wonders if it is possible that she doubted his love. On Brothel Row, his comrades are laughing, fucking, maybe haggling over the bill. Why shouldn't he find some pleasure there? What is wrong with him? Arikina likely gave his cap to the first indigent she met on the road. He hears a child weeping. Condry turns, puzzled. He has walked right out of the zone of festivities. Dark walls surround him. He is entirely alone. But the child, a little girl, probably, is somewhere quite near at hand. Not crying exactly, but whimpering. And he thinks, is that fear? He calls out, "Elu, Elu! Who's there?" No answer. But to his left there are thumps, shuffles, and the child's voice again. Yes, that is fear. That is terror, in fact. An abominable sound. "Whose girl is that? What's the matter with you people?" Suddenly a door creaks open. An old woman stands there, shriveled, naked to the waist. She gestures at him frantically.
"Away, go away!"
Then Condry smells it. Clove oil. Skem. He moves to the next hut. It is distinctly crooked, listing on its dirt foundation like a man in a stupor. The door, out of true, cannot quite close. A dim light flickers there in the darkness. Condry sets the bottle down, slides his fingers around the handle of the machete.
"Skem? You god's damn shitting animal!"
He tries to shout the words, but his voice has withered in his chest. His skin is cold and his hands are trembling. Pointlessly, he reaches out in the direction of the door.
"Skem? I'll fucking kill you!"
The words no louder than before. From the doorway comes a man's low grunt of pleasure. In the same instant, a child screams in pain. Condry feels himself go mad. He is through the door with the machete raised. By one candle he sees a man's rutting hips and the naked child on the bed, and then the man is up and flying at him with a long, bright knife. Condry sees his death in that knife. The man is viper quick, but his lunge is hampered by his lowered trousers, and there, dead. Condry's machete takes off his ear and splits his throat wide open. Dead, dead. Two more blows and the man falls in twitching pieces, and Condry's legs are drenched in blood. He staggers, drops the machete. The man is not Skem. The girl, 12 at the oldest, has risen to her feet, bloodied, cradling herself. Condry looks around for something to cover her, but when he turns, she shoves past him and flees through the open door. By the guttering candlelight, the dead man's blade gleams like gold. Voices, gasps, men and women flitting past the doorway. Condry curses in a non-stop whisper. He must get out of here, back to his tent. He must somehow clean the gore from his pants. Drunken fights are one thing, murder of a fellow soldier another. If they learn who did it, if someone, anyone, talks... The corpse lies face down.
"Who are you? Why the fuck do you smell like Skem?"
But in fact, the reek of cloves is gone. Has he imagined it? Is he truly going mad? He slides his boot under the man's ribcage, lifts. The corpse flops over, and Condry hurls himself back with a moan, not believing what he sees.
Oh, fuck. Oh, fuck!
The dead man is O'Julan. He has killed the prophet's favorite son. 2. A Void. Wicked child, by whose leave do you play with those embers? Were you not raised in a village of straw? Chiloto folk song. He picks up the machete. He lurches over the corpse, deeper into the shack, as though it were big enough to hide him. As though he could wait this out under the bed. The man's half-severed neck is almost in the doorway. The blood is steaming in the chill night air. O'Julan had lunged with the mataglin. His severed hand still clutches the priceless weapon, blood smearing the golden script. Mouth and eyes both open. His bare legs look strangely contented. The candle goes out. Condry gropes in the darkness. Something clean. On the straw mattress are underthings, a doll and a reek of different blood. The girls. He turns and plunges across the room. A bucket. A stool. At last a second bed and a rough woolen blanket. In the street, a woman calls out, her voice low with terror.
Sadina? Where are you?
Condry wipes furiously at his arm. Then he crouches and begins to swab his boots. There is a blaze of lamplight. Half a dozen figures are crowding the door. Villagers, silent and gaping. The one with the lamp, an old man with a face like a shriveled plum, bends to peer at the corpse. Then his eyes stab up at Condry.
You son of a worm-eaten bitch! They are going to kill us!
Help me, says Condry.
Help you? We should cut off your balls, or lock you in here and burn the place down. Save your army friends the trouble.
The girl, says Condry.
Is she... What girl, you talking turd?
Condry's head is reeling. He was fucking her.
And for that you kill him? Was she yours or something? Not a whore, a girl. Didn't you see her?
The change that comes over their faces is something he will never forget. They look at one another, naked with horror and revulsion. A woman hides her mouth in her hands.
Sadina? Where is Sadina? Aetherion?
Hers, the voice that had called in the street. She breaks and runs. Condry points a finger. The doll has fallen to the bloody floor.
I had to, he says. She was screaming. Can't you see I had to?
Silence. The old man passes the lamp into another's hands and steps up to Condry. His eyes are streaming, but his movements are precise. He looks at Condry's blood-spattered clothes.
Boy, he says, you should kill yourself. Hurry and do it. For your own sake, not ours.
There are murmurs of agreement.
Kill yourself. Kill yourself. Someone fetch him a razor, better this way than...
A jolt, a whisper. Suddenly everyone is fleeing for their lives. Someone is coming. There can be no other explanation. In seconds, he is once more alone. Except for one figure. A thin, sharp-elbowed woman, his age or slightly younger, has pushed forward while the others fled. Now she tears the blanket from his hands and spreads it on the floor. She takes the corpse by the ankles.
Lift!
He obeys, grabs O'Julan under the armpits. A bad dream. The head dangling, the mouth still open, the gleam of golden teeth. They place the corpse on the blanket, toss in his clothes and the doll and the mataglin, the girl's clothes, the bloodied sheets. They fold the blanket shut and lift. The woman gasps, and he recalls the first time, his first body, the shocking weight of the dead. They step out of the shack. The old man is waddling toward them with a bucket of water. He waves at them, frenzied.
Run! Run! Take it away!
Is the girl with her mother?
How should I know? Harak Eshet, just get out of here!
They run, Condry and the woman, the leaden corpse swaying between them. down alleys, through gates, over the tilled earth of lightless gardens, the young plants crushed beneath their feet. The moonlight weak and watery. He can barely see the woman, let alone the path ahead. Voices blow on the night breeze, clipped oaths, muffled cries. He braces for the roar of soldiers, the sudden barked command. Or nothing. Arrows. We're obviously stealing, and thieves are shot on sight. The walls about them vanish. Tall grass sighs around his legs. They have left the town and are thrashing across some fallow field. The woman falls, curses, rises with a groan. He can't recall if she has shoes. He understands why they must do this, why they must bear Ojulon far from any home. The old man will be furiously cleaning, tidying, trying to wash away the blood. It will not be enough. The prophet will have vengeance. If she cannot blame someone, she will blame everyone. She will put the whole village to the torch. The grass turns to thickets. They pass through a dry wash and over a low hill, and then the woman drops the blanket, letting the corpse fall to earth. She bends double, utterly winded, her gasping so loud he fears it will give them away. But there is no sound of pursuit, only the distant croaking of frogs about some wallow or water tank, and by the dim moonlight he sees why she has stopped. A shoulder-high barrier stretches across their path. It is a wall of beaten mud. After a moment, she gestures at the wall.
"This is the place. We'll heave him over. No one lives nearby.
They'll find him." A snorting laugh.
"You think?"
He could almost laugh himself. The hopelessness, his idiotic words. "This is Lord Ojulon. They will find him anywhere. They will peel the skin from the earth." Now he can smell it. Ojulon's blood, soaking through his trousers, drying on the hairs of his forearms. He is shaking. He is damned. He sets his back to the cool mud wall. They are common, these walls, the remains of cattle stockades from a time when the Malaya enjoyed more rain. The woman staggers about, catching her breath. After a moment, she nears him and brings her square-jawed face close to his own.
"Did he shove his prick in her?"
Condry cannot speak, and so his silence speaks. The woman turns and kicks savagely at the corpse. She drops, stifling a scream, both hands gripping her foot. Condry winces. She was shoeless after all.
"You kicked his Madeglin, I'm guessing," says Condry.
"You're lucky you didn't break a toe."
"Maybe I did. Tokra Katakuch, the shithog. That girl is 9 years old."
Condry gropes for the edges of the blanket. Still cursing, the woman rises, and together they lift the body and tip it over the wall. A soft thud and a crackle of underbrush. It is done.
"I'm sorry," says Condry.
The woman snorts again.
"You just threw your life away, for a girl you don't even know. We call you names, threaten you, tell you to take your own life, and then you help with the corpse. You're sorry? We should be kissing your feet."
Condry thinks of those moments of stillness, of cowardice, staring at the cracked door, whispering his threats.
"The pilgrim is returning," she says.
Her words startle him, although he already knows. The pilgrim is the world's second moon. A nomad, it appears in the skies every 21 years and stays barely a month. But in that brief season, nature loses her mind. Darkness never falls. Things weigh less than they should. Ocean tides swallow the shore. Condry has seen the pilgrim only once, as a child of 3. But he can still recall that reddish eye over the mountains, the trembling of the earth, and the feeling of precarious lightness, as though at any moment his small body could take to the sky. This time next year, it will all be happening again.
"What does the pilgrim have to do with Ojulon?" he demands.
"Nothing, until you killed him," she says. "But there's talk of ruin next year, of madness, and there are signs already. People say the Yatra strangled a man in his bed. Maybe that's a lie, But what about the other stories? A blue dog outside the temple, scratching at the door. And a rattlesnake, a sidewinder curled up in the alms bowl behind a locked door. The villagers are out of their heads with worry. They brought in an old priest to bless the town, but he just pissed everyone off. Instead of telling them how to stop the bad luck, he said it had barely started. He raved about death and blood and fire from the gods until no one could stand it anymore. We couldn't sleep. That old man had no mercy.
What did you do?
Stopped feeding him. The next morning he was gone.
What is that accent of hers? Sing-song and bitter at once. Condry cannot place it, but he knows he has heard it before. Years ago, or decades. In the darkness, a slurping sound. The woman is sucking the loose end of her sarong.
Why are you doing that? Asks Condry.
Blood spots.
He's impressed. This woman means to survive. They get to their feet, and she leads him south along the wall. Somewhere ahead he hears the clanging of goat bells.
Listen, he says. Was there a drug seller in the village tonight? A mean bastard, pushing wax?
You mean Skem? She says. Of course he was there. He arranges everything for Ojulon when that pig wants a young girl.
Wanted, I mean.
Condry draws a hand over his face.
All so simple.
A whiff of clove oil, a death. But what if he hadn't thought he was fighting Skem? Can he even pretend he would have found the courage to fight a son of heaven? Or would he have pretended to hear nothing? Walked right by? The image of the girl rises suddenly in his thoughts. Naked and so very tiny, like something skinned. What if they come looking for her in the morning? And this woman?
You should get away from me, he says aloud. Go back to the village and say nothing. I can find my way.
To where? Back to the camp? You look like you've just slaughtered a bull.
He follows her. The mud wall ends and the land flattens out. Ahead, a low triangular structure looms out of the darkness. It is a simple sun tent for goats and their keepers. At their approach, five or six animals leap up and scramble away. They are northeast of the village. He can see the brothels glow. But no emergency beacons, no running torchbearers light up Eternity Camp.
They haven't sounded an alarm, he says, amazed.
They don't dare, says the woman. Oh, they'll be sniffing around. But if they raised a stink and later find that he's just out whoring, well, Ojulon would slit their throats. He isn't supposed to screw around until 6 days after the feast.
Why not?
She shrugs.
None of the sons are. Don't you know? The prophet told them it would bring bad luck.
Gods, thinks Condry. Maybe she can see the future. Suddenly the woman tenses. Condry's hand flies to his machete, but it's just a boy, a village boy, running toward them like the wind. His bare feet spray earth at them as he slides to a stop.
Eshet, he gasps. Hurry, hurry, Je.
Under his arm is a tight bundle of clothes. The woman turns to Condry.
Strip those things off. The boy will get rid of them. Faru, you run west to the short grass. Find a rat hole, a deep one. Stuff them in with a stick.
Faru. Condry steps closer. It really is the boy he rescued from Skem. He looks at Condry with a mix of gratitude and fear.
You have a wicked bite, says Condry.
The child kneels and touches the ground with his forehead, a gesture of deepest respect. But his eyes are still fearful.
Oh, gods, says Condry. I'm not the Yatra. Skem just wanted another way to fuck with us. It was all he could think of to say.
The boy offers him the folded clothes. In broken Chilote, he says,
I kill Waxman, uncle. One day in his sleep.
No, no, don't try.
I curse him to burn, have pain forever. I stick the knife up his mulit.
You want to curse him? Stay alive. Grow up and fight all the Skems in this world. Fight to stop them from existing.
Eshet, that's your name, Eshet. Explain to him, will you? The boy nods vigorously.
Yes, uncle, yes, and thank you. Grow up, fight, stop existing. But first, I stick him dead.
God's damn it, says Condry. In a few hours, I'll be dead. A lot of people will be dead. Stay alive, you little shit. That's an order.
He takes off his clothes, reaches for the folded shirt and pants. Uncle. It is normal, an everyday honorific for an older man, but Condry can't recall ever hearing the term applied to him. Most villagers call soldiers Gifi, protector, even if they've never witnessed a single act of protection. For Condry, it is a source of abiding shame. No doubt Faro was still calling his attackers Gifi, even as they dragged him behind that wall. Condry freezes. The rough weave of the fabric, the weight, the feel of the buttons in the dark.
This is a uniform, he says.
Of course it's a uniform, says the woman. What did you expect, pajamas?
But where the hell did you get it?
From sisters, says the boy.
Sisters?
The woman looks out over the lightless plain.
I have a lot of them, she says. I'm a whore.
Now it is she who is naked. The fury in her voice, the struggle. She forces out a laugh.
We help each other. One of your comrades is passed out drunk beside his girl. Ong knows what he'll wear back to the camp.
And will your sisters cover for you tonight?
Fa,
she says. Where will you go tonight? Where are the rest of your people?
My people. Get your pants on. Are you losing your mind?
With that, she leaves him, running back along the wall. Condry dresses, looking down at the village. From where they stand, he can round it easily, in darkness, then follow the thorn fence back to the gate.
Don't let them see you out here, Faru.
Faru?
He turns in a circle. The boy is a shadow, racing over the grasslands with Condry's clothes, that burden of holy blood. At the gate, the sentries have been doubled. He walks straight for them in the center of the road, empty-handed, terrified, certain he looks deranged. You're walking like an imbecile, a drunk. And suddenly, salvation. That's perfect. A drunk. He twists his face into a smirk. He works his mouth, then forces out a song, lewd and low.
Oh, to warm my hands at midnight, in the pockets of my girl, in the sweet, secret pockets of my girl.
They wave him by, scowling. They are worried, but not about Condry Hingeman. Once more, hope flares in his breast. He's a slob. He's enchanted. He staggers all the way to his tent, and no one spares him a glance. In the tent, there is no light whatsoever. A few men are murmuring. A great many lie asleep. He feels his way to his cot. How many soldiers went to the brothels tonight? Maybe 200? What if they never suspect him? What if no one fingers him at all? He pulls the uniform shirt over his head. As his head emerges, the obvious answer materializes. A fiend's face in the dark.
What will they do?
Burn the village. Torture the villagers. Torture the soldiers until they cough up names. False names. True names. Your name. Anyone's. Slowly, he puts the shirt back on. The few men awake have noticed his stillness. He can feel their unseeing eyes. Before Mektu's rashness started, they were never hostile. One or two were almost friends.
Well,
goodbye. He has not really spoken, only moved his lips.
You're serious. Do you still have the bush kits?
I think so. Yes, I have them.
You mean it, Condry? You're not fucking around?
They stand in the darkness outside Mektu's tent, squinting, barely perceiving each other's faces. The only light comes from a distant security lamp at the end of the tent row. Condry has a thick canvas bundle under his arm. His right hand grips a lanyard, to which are tied four leather fosca, heavy with water. His left hand is twitching. His whole body aches with fear.
I took a sun shield from the unit reserve, he tells Mektu, and a long coil of rope. We'll need it for certain. I have 3 gold, true gold, from our mother. All my pays in gam coins. It's heavy, but we can't help that now. And we can't use the gate, of course. They'd never believe we were heading to the whorehouse with all this gear. But we can slide under the fence near the piker's latrines.
Under the fence?
Mektu blinks and rubs his forehead, perhaps still tempted to think this is all a dream.
The village dogs have scratched a hole there, says Condry.
I saw it yesterday, on trench duty. They won't have fixed it so soon. It will be tight, but there's no other way. His eyes are darting. He must not let them dart. Something is wrong. Something is changing. The shouts of late-night revelers are too few. At the end of the tent row, two officers pass through the cone of lamplight, rushing somewhere with urgent frowns.
Your boots? Says Condry.
Mektu stares at his bare feet.
Put them on, but wrap your feet first. We can't stop to deal with blisters. How much water is there anyway? In the tent? Wake the hell up, Mektu. How much water in the kits?
6 fasca each. Condry, what time is it? We must be too close to daybreak. Unless...
Mektu suddenly freezes. His eyes widen with disbelief. Condry's chest tightens.
You know, don't you? You can see it in my face.
Brother, whispers Mektu, aghast. Have you stolen us some horses? Oh, pitfire, Mech. Get the goddamned kits. Now, please. Or camels? Camels are no good in the mountains. Get the kits. You know when we should run, maybe, brother? Week's end, just after dark, when everyone's bellies are full and the whole night's ahead of...
Condry grabs his brother's face with both hands, pulls him close, feels his nails biting flesh.
Now, he says.
The astonishing thing is how little it takes to seal one's fate. A blind fumbling around the wall of a latrine, a ground-hugging slither under the fishhook tree fence, a scramble through the oily brush in the bottom of the trench. A few moments of almost suicidal blundering, their packs caught on brambles, items falling from their pockets, sticks loudly snapped underfoot. Curses, hysterical giggles.
Shut up, brother. You fucking shut up. You want to live or don't you? I'll be quiet if you...
Mektu stops in his tracks. Condry has started walking east.
The desert? Says Mektu's silence. Not the valley? Not home?
Condry turns on him, growling.
We've talked about this. I know, says Mektu. But I was just thinking, we could... If you say draw straws, I'll break your teeth.
I wasn't going to, says Mektu. And yet he stands there, wonderstruck, impervious to words. Condry's stomach is churning. He is on the verge of tears.
I'll leave you. Ong is my witness. I won't stand here arguing until they wake up and surround us.
Then Mektu starts and looks at him anew.
We could get away. Yes, come on. I mean, entirely away. Yes, yes, yes. That's the 50 times fucking idea. Well, let's do that.
And suddenly his brother is running, and Condry is beside him, laughing with terror and relief, and they are soldiers of revelation no more. At 15, they went mad for a girl named Arikina Nawal. Neither brother had yet spoken to her, but what of that? This was true love, and only one boy could claim her, and so they fought with fists and words and mocking laughter and lies. Condry has forgotten much about that foolish war, but he distinctly recalls dragging Mektu's best pants through the filth of the chicken coop and spotting his own school composition's book at the bottom of the outhouse hole. And the fistfight behind the kennel, egged on by 4 friends and 19 hunting dogs. His swollen lip, Mektu's black eye, the fight's sudden end when one of the bystanders stepped backward into a rubbish pit and broke his arm. Their feud was a nightmare for the family. Their sisters briefly took sides, then settled for even-handed contempt. Diakra Hingeman, who Condry had by now come to cherish, implored the gods to reveal how she'd earned such punishment. Their baby brother wept. He was large and plump, and his voice was astonishing. At table, if no one else managed to break the tension, he would rest his face in his food and just howl. The family dogs bayed in sympathy. The old man would look from Condry to Mektu and back again in bewildered rage. One night, he exploded from his chair. It was so unexpected that both boys leaped up in alarm. Lantor Hingeman grabbed them by the arms and hauled them out into the courtyard, scattering dogs and chickens. He made the brothers stand side by side. He ran his fingers through his hair.
"How many real sons do I have?" he demanded. "Just one. That screaming butterball. As for you two, I think gremlins came and snatched my two eldest from their cradles and left me a northy and a southy in their places."
"Condry didn't have a cradle. He had a pig trough," said Mektu.
The old man smacked him sideways.
"Horse trough," he said. "And that isn't true either. There was bedding, so shut up, Southie."
Mektu's eyes filled with tears, more from the insult than the blow. It meant the lesser of two bad specimens, the weaker of two runts. 80 miles south of Blind Stream, a deep rift called the Loro Canyon slashed through the coastal range. During the fall of the Empire, the central span of the Great Loro Bridge collapsed, leaving two stone arches yearning for each other in vain. In like fashion, the villagers on either side of the abyss lost all contact with each other. Neither wall of the canyon allowed for a descent, and restoring the bridge was as unthinkable as learning to fly. So the villages turned their backs on each other. Northies married and traded with the folk of the valley. Southies kept to the high country and married each other, and devolved into crude, cruel dimwits. Or so the valley folk contend. For well over a century, the two peoples grew apart. Then the prophet arrived, and her army set about proving itself the equals of the vanished empire. 5 years and 300 lives later, the bridge reopened, connecting the village for the first time in 8 generations. One might have predicted a joyous reunion. Not so. Competition for trade led to the first quarrels, but soon other conflicts arose. The slang of both groups had changed. Often these mutations were weird but harmless. The Southie word Eku, what, had come to mean when north of the Loro, whereas the Southie Eef, what, survived among Northies only as a request to speak up. Louder, please. But sometimes the confusion went deeper. Certain Northie phrases had changed among Southies into terms for sexual lust. This delighted just about everyone. In Eternity Camp, teasing Northie and Southie recruits was one of the durable joys of army life. Northie woman.
Is your husband thirsty?
Would your husband like a fuck? Southie woman.
What? When?
Northie.
Right now, of course.
Southie.
Are you insane?
Northie.
Well, forgive me for trying. And it's so hot today.
I'm so horny today. Southie woman gapes, sputters. Northie.
See? You're looking flushed yourself. Maybe you're thirsty.
Southie.
You damned dirty whore.
Northie.
What?
Louder, please.
Southie. You damned dirty whore!
And so on. The jokes no longer depend on linguistic truth. They have taken on a life of their own. But the mutual hatred of the Loro Canyon peoples is, and was, quite real. Condry can still hear the old man's final rebuke.
They were a family once. Now they're the laughing stock of Uroth. Is that how you want to end up?
With that, he had gone back to his dinner, leaving them alone. Condry will never forget the shame of that evening. But for his brother, the incident has always meant something else. Southie. That one word. Had their father chosen at random? Or had he known exactly what he was doing when he labeled Mektu the lesser of his sons? This is freedom. The stinking camp vanishing behind them, the pitch-dark Milea underfoot, morning cold like a snake bite, the silence broken only by themselves. Sweet odor of ginger weed, memories of mountain dawns, their path due east. The faintest dab of milky light on the horizon, better than a guiding star. But that light will grow into an enemy, Condry thinks. Mektu is perfectly right. They have started hours too late. How far can they hope to get before the day reveals them, reveals everything? Before the Rasanga issue from the camp like devils on horseback? They run parallel, long, straight strides. The packs are enormously heavy. The water alone adds 30 pounds to each. Still, they are riding a wave of fear and elation, and Khandri feels he could run this way forever. Mektu shoots him a sudden glance.
"The Iskralim," he huffs. "The fucking stolen sea. That's your plan, isn't it?"
Khandri nods as he runs.
"We have plenty of rope. The cliffs won't stop us, but they'll damn sure stop a camel or a horse."
"They might follow on foot."
"Might," Khandri winces.
"Doesn't matter," he says. "We'll find places to hide. If we make it to those cliffs, we lose them."
"But we won't make it."
"Yes, we will. Shut your mouth."
As a soldier, Khandri has developed another useful schism. That way lies death can coexist in his mind with, "That way I must go." The ability has saved him more than once, given him the clarity to charge the enemy or to flee over swollen rivers, burning fields. He knows also that they are fast, both of them. Running, fighting, fleeing, they do it all with impressive speed. It is one reason, besides blind luck, that they have survived 3 years of war. But horses are faster, and the cliffs lie 16 miles off. Mektu is right again. They will not make it, unless no one bothers to look east, or the sun fails to rise. He wrings more speed from his legs.
Idiot. Face facts. Someone will look east. Wolf packs, the army's term for death squads, will ride out on their trail.
He and Mektu will be captured, miles before the cliffs. Before the day's end, they will be flung at the prophet's feet. They will die screaming, mutilated, mauled. For the sake of a village girl, a stranger, a naked child in the dark.
"Mek," he cries into the wind, "we'll buy horses in Balanje."
"What?"
"Balanje, the village. We have to run through it, almost..."
"I know where Balanje is. What kind of horses are we going to find in that dump?"
"Kind with four legs. What do we care?"
Balanje, the last settlement, lies just 3 miles ahead. They can hope to reach it in darkness, or at worst, half light, and with horses they will reach the cliffs in time. There, already, the spur trail leading into the village. The ground is firmer, better for running. A whiff of a cook fire. Mektu, a few paces ahead, calls to Khandri over his shoulder.
"We'll steal the horses. We won't pay them a gam."
Right again. Better to rob the villagers, leave them blameless. The thought brings Khandri another flash of understanding. They have not just become the prophet's enemies. They have become enemies of all who love her, or try to love her, or pretend. Yes, this is freedom. They have escaped the madhouse by leaping from a high window, barely glancing at the earth beneath them, laughing as they fall. Balanje. A village shrunken into itself, an ancient spot that never flourishes or dies. They hear the dogs first, then the wavering call of a milk seller urging mothers to rise and unbolt their doors.
"Pegri na clanet!"
White and fresh. In the Satapre Valley, the same cry announces daybreak. Once more, hapless fool, Khandri breaks into a grin. The town rises before them, a congregation of humble rectangles and domes, mud-brick walls, goat pens, hayricks waiting for spring. And there are the dozens of low, squat towers that are Balanje's only fame, prayer platforms, their flat roofs blazing in the first light of the sun. But Khandri sees no one atop the platforms. No sign of the morning prayer at all.
"Pegrina!"
Strange. The milkseller has fallen silent in mid-cry. They leap over a brush fence, and are at once in the heart of the settlement. Nothing moves. They turn in a circle, gasping. Not a soul to be seen. A door booms shut. A child cries out and is quickly silenced. Mektu looks at Khandri in distress. We startled them, says Condry. Mektu nods uncertainly. They walk along the main row of houses. Their footfalls ring loud in the empty air. A white cat flees before them. Windows go dark as they approach. Condry has been here before. All told, there might be 200 homes, but some stand empty, for life is hard in Belange. The well is meager, the water tastes of mud. A twisted bonewood tree marks the village center. Standing near it, you can throw a rock beyond the last house in any direction.
Where are the stables? Asks Mektu.
I don't recall, Condry admits. Mektu steps up to a rude wooden door, smacks it with the flat of his hand.
Doro! Doro! Come out, brothers! Don't you want to earn some gold?
Silence, then a soft thump from within.
I heard that, cries Mektu.
When Condry tugs his arm, Mektu launches himself across the street to an adjacent house. This time he beats harder.
Wake up! Wake up! We're Chilotos! Chilotos, like you! Help your brothers for Ong's sake! I don't care who you're sleeping with!
The light is growing. Condry glances over his shoulder and sees a face draw swiftly back from a window. Why are they so terrified? They can't possibly know. His brother, too, has begun to look frightened. Condry points down the rutted lane. The old bonewood tree stands 50 feet ahead. They hurry toward it, and to Condry's immense relief, he spots a figure seated beneath the twisted canopy. It is a frail old man, bald and brown. His face is mushroom-shaped, cheekbones so much wider than chin. Shirtless, he sits on a rock beneath the tree, both hands gripping the knob of a battered cane. As they approach, he does not move so much as a finger. He is gazing up into the last of the dark.
"Hello, Grandfather," says Condry. "Please, can you tell us?"
"Stables!" blurts Mektu.
"Are there any stables in this town? Any horses at all?"
The man sucks his dark lips into his mouth. His bony hands writhe on the knob of the cane. Mektu bends over him and shouts,
"Horses! Can't you hear me? Horses, or even a camel! We can pay, if that's what you're worried about!"
Condry crouches down. The man could well be 4 times his age.
"Please, Grandfather," he repeats.
The dry lips part. The old man speaks for half a minute, then taps the earth with his cane. The brothers look at each other. Condry has not caught a word.
"He doesn't speak Chilote," says Mektu. "Son of a junkyard bitch!"
Condry repeats their question in Khosraji. The old man responds in the same language.
"No horse can help you," he says. "It is Darsunuk, the time of madness. When the wise fall silent, and armies march against phantoms, and the gods weep tears of fire."
He lifts the cane and points at the sky.
"I watch them, boys, the stars that wander, the stars that spin on heaven's wheel."
"Horses," says Mektu.
"Some call it the everlasting wheel,"
the old man continues.
"They are ignorant. Nothing lasts. The spokes rot. The axle breaks. The cart is overturned. Heaven's bounty spills by the roadside. And you."
He lowers the cane, pokes Condry in the chest.
"Know this better than anyone. You can sense the fall of night."
Condry stares at him, chilled.
"The night's almost over, uncle,"
he says, gently removing the cane.
"No,"
says the old man.
"The night is just beginning. Save yourselves."
Mektu stamps his foot in frustration.
"He has to urinate,"
says the old man.
"Or perhaps he knows the truth. Run fast and run far, children. Darsunuk has come."
A thought flashes in Condry's mind. the old priest the villagers brought to Eternity Camp, the one who frightened them half to death with his doomsday talk. Could this be the man?